Clearly, when you've already established the Glasgow Centre for Reproductive Medicine and you've graduated from the University of Edinburgh, you have earned the right to actually be referred to as a medical expert in reproductive medicine. Now, to address the issue of the possible changing of IVF into the EVA test and via the EVA test in terms of how we can actually cope with infertility, we're delighted to welcome the wonderful, fantastically talented Dr. Marco Gowden. How are you, Marco?
Good morning.
Good to connect with you, good self. I was just looking in terms of dates because you actually graduated from Edinburgh around about 10 years or so after, of course, Louise, the first test tube baby, was actually born from that point of view. So it's interesting to see where things are progressing.
Well, they've progressed hugely in the last 30 years, absolutely.
And this particular instance, of course, is very much the possible answer to many couples' prayers in terms of how you can actually improve fertility and address the question of infertility.
Yes. Well, what EVA, or early embryo viability assessment, what it's doing is it's time-lapse technology with unique computer algorithms to look to see exactly how the cells are dividing. An embryo starts off as a single cell. That cell divides into two cells, two divides into three, and then so on and so on. And so the what the technology is doing is determining when the cells divide, because we've known for many years that is actually crucial to the viability and the quality of that embryo ultimately to turn into a baby. And previously, it's been a black box. We now have these technologies, of which EVA is the most sophisticated. And what it's allowing us to do is to be able to assess embryos so much better, and that then allows us to select the best embryos to be transferred.
And in terms of the actual technology itself, it's presumably it's not invasive. It's a case of it's using the sort of current use of, as you said, time lapse imagery, etc., to kind of provide this image of really getting the right time. It's all about timing, I presume.
Yeah, well, actually, Alex, that's a good point. I mean, the other advantage of it is that you're not disturbing the embryos. Traditionally, you take the embryos out each morning to look at them to see how they've developed, how they've moved on. What you're not having to do now is to take them out each morning. So that in itself is a benefit, but the main benefit is about assessing how they are developing, and that then allows us to be much more selective in which embryos we choose, which in turn means we can actually move more to single embryo transfer, which does then reduce the risk of twins. Again, a positive benefit.
Yes, precisely, because obviously multiple births, sometimes even triplets, even quadruplets and so on, that's been a kind of byproduct sometimes in the past of IVF, I believe.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And so what these there's been a move, and quite rightly so, to move towards more single embryo transfers. What we need is technologies like EVA, where it allows us to do these things in a non-invasive manner and be very specific in order to be able to achieve that. And we've just completed a study up in Glasgow, which has shown that with EVA technology, where we're transferring the embryos on day three, compared to what's called blastocyst transfer, which is a day five embryo, that then what we've shown is that the live birth rates are exactly the same with EVA, but you're getting those two extra days of what we call endometrial dialogue, which then allows the embryos to interact with the endometrium, the lining of the womb, much better. And longer term, we believe that's actually going to have a benefit for the health of the baby and indeed the adult, and there's exciting data on that, which has been growing for the last few years.
People are listening to this, they're coming from all kinds of environments and so on. I'm sure folk will say, yes, this could be ideal for myself. But who exactly is the EVA test suitable for in terms of folks who are thinking, would they benefit from this, or would it be worthwhile exploring the EVA test?
If it costs nothing, we would do it for everybody, because it's giving us so much in the way of insights. We see couples where they have had multiple IVF cycles, have had apparently good quality embryos, and yet are never getting pregnant. And then they come to us for EVA, and what we find is, in fact, their embryos are all dividing at the wrong rates, and we still transfer the embryos, but if they don't get pregnant, at least they now have an answer as to why it's not happening for them. And for them, that's been a huge release. Another example actually has been, we had a couple who had multiple miscarriages, seven or eight miscarriages, and they eventually came to us for EVA, and what we found was that, in fact, only one of their eight embryos was actually a good quality embryo, despite them all looking good. And she now has a baby, but because of the technology.
Looking again at obviously the tests that Eva went through, clearly it was a multi-centre clinical trial, 160 patients, 1,825 embryos were actually scanned from that, so it's perfectly safe from that point of view. But as we said at the top of the piece, Marco, you're obviously based up in Glasgow. Do people actually need to head to Scotland for this? Is it a case of will you be rolling it out across the United Kingdom? What's the availability of the Eva test?
Well, obviously, we were the second unit in Western Europe to get Eva. But if you come south of the border, as it were, Liverpool, the Hewitt, has Eva, as does Daresbury Park in Manchester. Birmingham Women's have Eva, and then Bourne Hall in Cambridgeshire also do. And you come further south again into London, the Homerton, I understand, has Eva, and Wessex Fertility near Southampton. They also have Eva. And then there's two units in Northern Ireland in Belfast that also have it. So it's growing because really what we've shown from our work is that the technology works, basically. And from a clinical point of view, that's important for patients.
Further information, presumably via the World Wide Web, is there a particular go-to website? Would it be bmihealthcare.co.uk or other sort of more focused sites?
It wouldn't be BMI. It would be... For our website, for instance, gcrm.co.uk, you can see videos there, but probably the easiest for patients is actually to go on YouTube and just Google Eva, E-E-V-A, and you'll see the really cool videos of actually how embryos are developing. And also, I think you probably can Google Eva and just get kind of other websites as well for the more specific for the actual side of things. But the YouTube videos are very cool.
And not to be confused, of course, with the co-star in the Disney movie Wall-E, of course, who is Eva. This is Eva 2.3, which I suppose sounds as though it's a variation of its own routine. Do you think there's going to be an Eva 2.4? Have we actually reached the peak from this point of view? I mean, again, we said about how rapidly changes are occurring with respect to IVF. Will there be a sort of further step along the line, do you suspect?
Oh, absolutely. The attraction for us at GCRM when we were looking at the different time-lapse technologies was that the guys at Stanford University were quite open and said, this is not the finished product. We've been using 2.2 for the last 2 years, and that's the work we've kind of worked with and the work we'll be publishing. Version 2.3 of the software is now looking at five different parameters of cell health, which we hope is going to allow us to be much more specific about which embryos we choose. To be fair, we've only had version 2.3 of the software for a month, so we're still getting to grips with it. But the guys in Stanford are working all the time on looking at the technologies and seeing what else can we learn from what's happening to these embryos and then build that into these unique computer algorithms.
Marco, it's been fascinating just touching base with yourself about what, as we said at the start of the piece, has progressed so rapidly since, say, those days back in the 1970s were, again, the cause celebre of the first ever test tube baby and where that would actually lead. This is, as I say, non-invasive. It's a wonderful sort of opportunity to actually develop various other factors. Two final questions for your good self. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the Midrick Drive today?
Very much so, yes, thank you.
Excellent. So can we hopefully prevail upon you to join us again in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised, obviously, as we head to Eva 2.4 and beyond?
I'd be delighted to.
This is the house that Funk built. Groove of modern style. All right, I'm checking all y'all out this evening. I see you sitting around. But we ain't gonna have none of that this evening, child. That's right. Don't be looking at me like that. See, my name is Grandma Funk, y'all.
On the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for culinary class and gastronomic gorgeousness with the broadcasting legend who is William Sitwell.
Quite right too. If you're going to follow Eva technology for embryos and improving birth rates and so on, what better way than to have Groove Armada underpinning I See You Baby with William Sitwell, the man for whom actually Lincolnshire Day could almost have been built. Happy Lincolnshire Day, William Sitwell.
Yeah, and a merry day of Lincoln to you too, and everyone in the village. I hope they put that in the bunting. I hope that they're slaughtering pigs. I hope they're carving turnips or whatever else you do on Lincolnshire Day. Getting out the Lincolnshire cheese and the ales.
We've got the Lincoln Red, you've got the Lincolnshire Red, you've got obviously the tendency to dress in yellow to celebrate the yellow belly nature of the whole thing. Oh, it's gone crazy. Nothing to do with the fact that 1975 there was the first ever Yorkshire Day. So in 2006, of course, it became October the 1st, Lincolnshire Day. Anyway, and relax. So
very good. What it does actually is it paves the way to my own birthday.
Exactly.
And when the cycle is ripe, you know, I remember actually walking off a hill in Perthshire, and you weren't able to track me down, so I got birthday greetings left to you on my aunt's phone when I came off the hill.
And this is the point, because October, it's not just Katie Grimmison's birthday month. It's not just Natalie Tuck's birthday month. It's William Sitwell's birthday month as well. Yay! Celebrate and rejoice, as Eva would rightly say. So, meanwhile, where exactly do we find you this fine Lincolnshire Day, William?
All right, you find me in Earl's Court in London.
Oh.
Having rather spoilt myself last night at a very famous restaurant that's just been reopened called Le Pont de la Tour, which was opened by Terence Conran about 20 years ago, and it's now owned by D&D Restaurants, and they've spruced it up. So I went there last night and had a modest little dinner, and I'm sure the people of your village will appreciate that my honesty in explaining what I had, which was caviar followed by lobster thermidor followed by crepe Suzette with a little bit of Moët & Chandon champagne, a lovely white burgundy. And London was looking pretty beautiful after that. It was looking quite good before as well. But, I mean, that was my way of celebrating Lincolnshire Day.
And we
all have to have our own individual ways of celebrating, and that's what I did.
As ever, you have the eye of the artist when you choose what to share on your Facebook page. And Eva and myself are currently just captivated, really partly to do with last night's coverage of Lyrical Mallards, which was released to the world yesterday, all about serious squirrels around the world. Yes, nothing to do with ducks. But we were captured by the sharing of Heart London's video about the mummy duck who kept quacking at people passing by a drain until they actually discovered her little ducklings were in there.
William,
it's a very sweet. It's a lovely story, that, isn't it? I think it's somewhere in Austria or somewhere in Europe.
You have a heart as well. In fact, I mean, I'm sharing this as we speak. You know, so I just felt it's important to actually. It's what Mark Zuckerberg would have wanted us to do. You know, so it's just so wonderful in terms of that.
There seems to be a lot of chat on Facebook at the moment about privacy and whether they're about people are copying and pasting those notices saying that their photos are private and so on. And there is obviously concern about it. But I think, to be honest, if you post stuff on Facebook, that's publishing. Mm. Even if you think it's private, if you don't want people to look at it, Don't pop it on a website.
I tend to agree. I mean, so there has been a teeny-weeny issue, no names, etc., but one of our midweek drivettes, actually, as I've just showed to Eva, was the subject of, obviously, a fan-slash-stalker who actually wants us to arrange dinner with her. I think, you know, we don't do that. It's not,
no.
It's not a dating agency, son. All right?
When you call them, you call them midweek drivers, they sound like they're sort of driving around in vans, delivering midweek stuff.
Yeah, well, they've got midweek drivettes. You know, that's the whole thing. They're effectively delivering good entertainment to the listenership of the world. That's the essence. So, yeah, it's very much there. Anyway, let us progress from that. We were talking about ancestry DNA. How many cousins do you actually have, William, that you know of?
How many cousins I have? What an interesting question. On my father's side, I have one, just one, Alexandra Sitwell, and because my great aunt Edith, the poet, and her brother Osbert never married. She was returned unopened, as her biographer once said. And so my grandfather was the only one who married, and he had two sons, and his older son only had one. So that's on that side. Then on my other side, the progeny of an amazing man called Ronald Cross, who was Minister for Economic Warfare and Governor of Tasmania. He had four daughters, one of whom was my mother. And they produce quite a few. So I'm not quite sure how many there are at the moment. Well, but I think it's in double figures.
And more than that, William, because as we've recently found, for courtesy of Ancestry UK and Sir Tony Robinson these days, of course, Sir Tony Robinson, who's discovered he's actually a Viking, we actually have probably at least 111 cousins we don't know about anything, in essence, because they are related.
Well, it depends when. Yeah, but I'm talking about first cousins. So if you're then talking about second cousins,
no. We are specifically talking about first cousins globally, in terms of the connection there. The ancestry DNA test suggests that if you calculate all of the cousins of William Sitwell, you will have effectively enough to fill Wembley Stadium twice
over.
Well, I
think you're casting aspersions on the morality of my other side of the family. You're telling me that there may be a few love children that we know about. You're telling me that there are dozens of love children we don't know about.
Well,
you better put that to the descendants of the Cross family and explain yourself.
It's not just the Sitwell family. It's the McDonald families. It's the Leftchuk families. We all have... If you walk across Britain, according to this survey, you'll find about two cousins per square mile that you didn't even know. Mind-blowing start to the day, William, but we felt if anybody could actually handle that information, you could. Because that's particularly
Thank you. The big decision I've had to make is I'm halfway through breakfast, and I've decided that I started healthy, so I have a avocado on toast with a poached egg, and then I just put I just ordered a little side order of black pudding.
Fried congealed blood. What perfect way. What a perfect start. I personally started off today with a cheese sandwich, but each to their own. That's the important thing.
Well, that's just wrong. You know, sandwiches are not meant for breakfast. You need to listen to what I've been telling you every week for the last dozen years.
Well, William, you are so true, but forgive me, William, I have sinned. It's going to all sorts of other areas. Eva, any thoughts or questions for William before we actually trail ahead once more to the excitement that will be next week, where we have four Newcastle people connected with the show?
Well, William, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, I'm alive.
Yeah.
Sun's shining.
What's your plans for the day?
Plans for today?
Plans for next week or whenever.
Well, I'm working on a pitch for to do a magazine in Singapore, so so my mind will be on that. I'm trying to hire some talent in Singapore. I'm just working on the launch of the magazine we're about to launch in Boston. So that's quite exciting. And then I'll be doing a few things to do with our London project, such as Waitrose. And then if I've got time, I might see if I can write some more words for my next book. But I'll be in the office in London, so anyone wants to drop by.
One of these days we'll take you up on that offer, William. But sadly not today, because it's so Lincolnshire Day. How could we leave the county when
it's so
Lincolnshire Day? Honestly, it is. As we said, next week we have the return of Professor Scott Davidson, our Deputy Vice Chancellor of the University of Lincoln, who is looking forward. In fact, I had a brief chat with him last week, and he said, "Is that wonderful William Sitwell going to be on the show next week?" I said, "I hope so. I seriously hope so." Because, 9:25 on Thursdays without the Sitwell Meister and or cousins, it's not worth living. That's the important thing. So I take it, William, you've had an okay link with us today as we kind of randomly selected DNA testing, the whole notion of the right kind of way to celebrate Lincolnshire Day, and, of course, what did you have for breakfast as the topics?
Well, I think you leave it to the villagers to make that judgment as to whether this is golden radio or not.
Eva, you are the sole representative of a Lincolnshire soul person, genetically here.
Thank you.
Is it right that William should be continued with on the programme?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think so.
So hopefully, William, you will return in about 168 hours from now.
Yeah, that sounds like good to me. I'm going to go back and hopefully some black pudding will have arrived.
On 107.3 FM, where it is almost precisely, in fact, will be in 10 seconds' time, 9:40 a.m. That's 9:40. No, it isn't. It's 9:36. Honestly, time, it's such a strange, wibbly wobbly concept, isn't it, even McDonald's?
It is.
It's actually 9:37 precisely now. Well, 9:37 and 3 seconds. But we don't want to fill the remaining sort of 20 minutes of the show by simply counting down, because Alan Stevens is here. He has arrived. Yay, Alan!
Yeah. Hey, sorry, just been up. Song was on there. It was. You said you played a little clip to me. And it said, "In a wood full of princes, freedom is a kiss, but the prince hides his face from the dreams in the mist." And I'm just trying to think, what the hell does that mean?
Well, it's Lincolnshire Day, Alan. So, what can I say? Happy Lincolnshire Day to you.
Whoa, Lincolnshire Day. How old is Lincolnshire now?
Well, Lincolnshire Day as a celebration effectively started in 2006. So from that perspective, the celebration of the wondrousness that is Lincolnshire has really only been going for 8 years. Nine years.
Before then, no one celebrated it.
Tragically, no.
It was just neglected.
It was left alone as the birthplace of Jim Broadbent, Margaret Thatcher, and other luminaries. But there were...
Oh, I can see why you might forget about that.
But we did have Isaac Newton and George Boole, so, you know, on the
plus
side.
Oh, he's all right. Yeah,
exactly.
Or Isaac.
Exactly, without which we'd be floating all over the place, really.
Yeah, terrible.
Thank heavens for the apple.
Moving on. He invented that, you know.
Exactly. So Eva has made a revelation during the piece of heart there by saying that she used to be quite a fan of Doctor Who, and so did her brothers and sisters. You know, brothers and sisters,
they
were sort of a family thing.
Yeah, they still are.
Kind of less so now. Tried Matt Smith a few times.
I did try Matt Smith a
Peter
few
Capaldi,
times,
not
but
the
writing...
Writing.
Not the same as Russell T Davis, I'm afraid.
No.
I'm afraid to give it a chance, though.
I've heard a lot of interesting polarised views, including one of my science fiction students who, I think, uttered the words, Stephen Moffat has killed my show, which I think is harsh, personally.
Oh, no, I don't think he's killed it.
Exactly.
He's just altered it.
I think it's harsh, it's natural. The key thing, the finger in the air, the test that ultimately is the litmus test when it comes to who and how it sits together. Clearly, it's with your good self, Alan. So we had part one. You said, yeah, that's okay. Could be. I used your very phrase with several of my students. I said, we're speaking with Alan Stevens, and his line was, it's simply a Gallifreyan bucket list in terms of the shades, sonic shades as well, sonic sunglasses, and the guitar and the tank and so on. Did it work for yourself, Alan Stevens?
Sorry, what are we talking about there? The bucket list thing or the episode?
I think the episode. I think we'll keep it to the episode. We'll work on that basis, and then we won't confuse people more than they might already be confused.
Okay. The thing is that with Doctor Who under Moffat, and actually RTD, there's not a great deal of difference between the two of them, to be honest. Except perhaps things make a bit more sense under Moffat than they did under RTD. But the thing is, they throw a lot of stuff at you. And it is not always necessarily coherent. You know what I mean? You're not, at the end of the episode, you don't have to think, well, I understood that entirely. You've often got to go back and watch it again to sort of work out whether, you know, it did work or it didn't work. And so, you know, in the services of Alex Luchek, I actually stayed up last night and watched it through again. So there you are.
Whoa, yeah.
I spent time and watched both episodes, one after the other. In fact, it was the omnibus version I watched, which is actually slightly different. And I thought it was all right. Yeah, I enjoyed it. So there you go.
Well, relief could be heard being expelled from Stephen Moffat all the way over from Cardiff.
Yeah, I'm sure Stephen is immensely thrilled. He listens to the show, I know, and he hangs on my every word.
It's the way forward, you know, clearly, from that perspective. So, yeah. And overall, I mean, I was asked a similar question by head of news at Siren, and I sort of responded by saying, yeah, I mean, you know, consider the alternative. You know, consider the alternative, another version of The Voice, or indeed Strictly Come Dancing, emerging in that particular place. So I think from that perspective, it's okay, honestly.
I mean, how can I put this? There is an underlying story to a lot of these Dalek stories. In fact, to most of season 8 and most of season 1 and bits of other ones. But it's this idea of, is the Doctor a good guy or a bad guy, you know? And
for a moment, I thought they might actually say the Doctor was Davros and vice versa. But
well, that's very good, isn't it? Because I mean, there's certain things that Missy does. I mean, Missy's obviously an evil person, but also has this bond with the Doctor on a very, very deep level. And there's certain things that she does which points up, you know, things. She's kind of Mephistopheles in character. And so you have like in the previous story, the last season, you had in story Death in Heaven, she says, well, here's an army. And he says, I don't want an army. And she goes, yes, you do. You want an army? Here's a Cyberman army. They will, you know, everyone they kill is immediately turned to a Cyberman. It is an invincible army. You can use it to free all those people trapped in Dalek death camps. You can go across the universe and you can make the good people win. And the Doctor goes, and he said, like, that's no one really should have that power. But I'm giving it to you. That is what you want. And he rejects it. He says, well, I'm not a good man. I'm just an idiot flying around in a police box, and that's it. And Danny Pink effectively is the one who takes the Cybermen away and removes the
threat.
You've got to have this army thing. Yeah. But the fact is, the next story, we're back to this idea again of the Doctor thinking, well, I don't like the Daleks, do I? And that kid's Davros, so let's let him die. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's going back in time and killing the small boy who will grow up to be an evil, ruthless dictator. So he hasn't. It is an argument that's been going on the show, I think, certainly since Rose, and probably has its origins, well, obviously in Genesis of Daleks, and probably Revelation of the Daleks, where the Doctor, no, Remembrance of the Daleks, sorry, where the Doctor actually blew up Skaro. So, you know, I think there's this unresolvable argument or dichotomy or whatever in the Doctor, and many of the stories revolve around that. I mean, for example, inside the Dalek, you had the idea that, you know, the Doctor goes inside his miniaturized and goes inside the Dalek, and the Dalek, they sort of like mind meld or whatever you call it, and the Dalek says, well, I see inside, you hate the Daleks, you know, I see hatred in you, and he goes off. And the Dalek exterminates all the other Daleks, so the Daleks are evil, and says, you know, basically, you know, you would make great Dalek. So we've got this interesting stuff. You know, the Doctor is the Doctor a hero, or is he in fact a man who's declared war against the universe and is using all his companions as soldiers in that war, simply so he can say, I'm a man of peace, I don't shoot anyone. So yeah, I quite like that.
So there you are, Eva. That's why you should make use of those wonderful computerized systems and give the show another chance. Alan, stay with us. We want to talk about The Worst of the Mohicans, alternatively 27 cool things about Time and the Rani, and 23 oh, yeah. stupid ones.
Yeah.
Are you interested in video games? If so, be sure to join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den, your weekly dose of tech and games. Treat yourself to the latest news, interviews, some brilliant music, and much more. After all, it is approved by...
me, Duke Nukem.
Kane from Command & Conquer.
Agent 47.
Colonel Roy Campbell.
And more. So join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den. Every Wednesday, 10 till 12.
On Siren FM, 107.3.
Tremendous show, but possibly a little bit too much Rammstein Slipknot. Just for my mind of little things, though. You know, sometimes it gets a bit scary. You know, we're quite happily sort of working through the processes, and then Jake goes all Rammstein and Slipknot on us. But still, I have revealed, for Eva McDonald's benefit, the website that is Magic Bullet, that is KaldorCity.com, and we're currently looking at what? We're looking at...
The Magic Bullet.
The Magic Bullet, 27 Cool Things About Time and the Rani, launched on September the 1st. So a bit late in covering this, but obviously you can sort of interact in every sense of the word. What possessed your good self and Fiona to actually start producing these lists, Alan? Is it a case of, yeah, Time and the Rani has been nixed in lots of ways. It's time to actually revisit an article in the Celestial Toy Room, issue 444, and make it public to the world?
Well... back in 2003, when we were doing the Calder City CDs, or was it 2002? I don't know. Anyway, the Duras contacted me, a guy called Paul Winter, and he said, would I like to do a signing with their a convention they were doing, because I think, I'm not quite sure who was going on. I think Nick Courtney was going, yeah. I think Paul Darrow was going, and so he said, we could do a signing for your CD, and I said, yeah, okay. And I went along, and somewhere along the line, I think either I suggested it, or Fiona suggested it, or they suggested it to us, that because we were doing articles on the Calder City website, basically to promote, you know, sales and stuff and make ourselves noticed, they said, well, we're always on the lookout for articles, and there's a few on your site we would love to print, and can we do that? And so it ended up them printing articles off the website to us eventually writing articles for them, which we then, once they published, put on the website. And we used to do reviews, and then people like lists, don't they? You know, fans like lists, and it's easier to write a list anyway. So we started doing these lists. And the reason we got to Time of the Rani is because I'm planning to do an interview with Andrew Cartmel, who I met a few months back in very, very
former
nice.
Former script
guy
editor, of course. Person
who script editor.
Stepped into
on
the shoes. Of, yeah, exactly.
That's right. But I kind of before I do any interviews, I always want to thoroughly know the subject. So which meant I had to watch Tom the Rani or borrow it and watch it, and therefore also if I did an article on it, then I can go back and say, ah, right, so yeah, Lacertian, that comes from whatever means lizard. So, yeah, we basically worked our way right to the McCoy era. We missed a few ones we previously reviewed, and also there was one story which I just couldn't think anything to say about. It was Paradise Towers. It was just, we started it, and we got about, you know, by episode three, we'd only written down 15 things, so we just stopped on that one.
Personally, a classic favourite for me, jumping straight to number one in the list of things you've just suggested about Time and Their Army, we'd just like to point out Mel's amazing self-cleaning trousers. She falls down in a quarry and gets mud all over her white slacks, but seconds later, they're shiny clean again.
Amazing.
Yay!
Well, they got that, but they invented that material later, didn't they? Some sort of thing in it we could self-cleaning, I don't know, did they?
It's a classic. And you see, Eva, what magical things you could discover before you were even born by actually going back in time, using the medium of the digital technologies to actually sort of access this. It'll fill the year out you're taking between sort of music college and sort of post A-level stuff.
I suppose so, yes.
It's way forward.
It was interesting what you were saying earlier, about someone saying, you know, Doctor Who's been killed by, you know.
I don't say it's been killed. I think that's a bit far.
Not you, but so didn't someone say that Doctor Who was dead?
Yes, one of my other students did actually say that Stephen Moffat has killed her programme.
Oh, dear.
It's very interesting you should say that, because, I mean, I was alive when this story came out. I think I was probably 22. Yeah. And there was a similar kind of discussion then. I remember a good friend of mine called Alastair Locke was talking to a guy on the phone, and Alastair thought it was, Tom and Ronnie was awful. And this guy got really offended that Alastair did not think Time and the Rani was, you know, the greatest story ever, and slammed the phone down on him. And various other people were going away and saying, Doctor Who is dead! Doctor Who is dead! And, you know, well, it was how long ago now? 1987. So Doctor Who died in 1987.
Over
and probably
a quarter
died
of a century.
Yeah, so, you know, it's been dead for a long, long time now, so I don't kill it anymore, you know.
But
fans are like that, though, aren't they? They fans do get very personal, very, you know, involved. I mean, I do as well. You know, I mean, people get very involved in, like, a football team or favorite TV show. They become emotionally involved in it, and if it doesn't conform to exactly what they think makes good TV, then they go really get upset about that. You know, but I can understand it. You know, I mean, I've watched stories when I go to the Forest of Dean, I watch as a friend of mine, and we watch the new Who episodes, like, you know, we started with Rose and we're now up to Nightmare and Silver, and it's funny, you reassess them, you watch stories which you watched 2 years back and thought were terrible, and you watch them and think, well, actually it wasn't too bad, or vice versa as well. But, you know, I think you can't really be too dogmatic on this. You know, I mean, I might watch The Witch is Familiar again in 6 months and think, actually that was really, really boring. Do you know what I mean?
It's all to do with state of mind and mood.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I went to cinema once and saw a film called Shallow Grave, and I thought it was absolutely awful.
And yet Danny Boyle's career was built on it.
Yeah, well, when I watched it, when I saw it on TV, when it was eventually broadcast on Channel 4 about 2 years later, I watched it, I thought it was really, really good, and I couldn't make the connection between why I hated it so much. Yeah. But it must have been the mood, or the popcorn, or perhaps I had a dodgy hamburger, I don't know.
Which is why you should always beware the words of critics. Richard Fitzwilliams, I hope you're still listening. Just a thought there. I know you gave full thumbs up to the Scottish play and indeed the intern with Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro, of course, not in the Scottish play because that was Michael Fassbender. Anyway, that's pretty much the wrap-up as far as we're almost concerned. I'm just going to squeeze in a couple of key things from the wonderful world of John Wenham's events diary. But, Eva, would you like to put those last two questions to the creator of Caldor City, the co-creator of Magic Bullet Productions, and, I mean, I can't believe that you actually download even more bundles of goodiness as audio from the whole thing. Would you like to throw those last two questions to Alan, please?
Oh, Alan, have you had an interesting and very informative, I suppose, informative?
I think it's been very informative. Yeah.
Informative telephonic link with us today?
Yes, it's funny, really, because I was... What's the date today? Is it the 1st?
It's Lincolnshire Day, Alan.
Yeah,
October the 1st.
It's normally on the 1st of the month I put up a new article, and we've actually got one to put up, but Fiona was knocked off her bike by a car two days ago.
Oh, yeah. That is not... Was she wearing a crash helmet? Seriously, was she...
Sure, she wears the full enchilada, but she's still got a black eye out of it.
Oh, well, well, but there is a moral in the story there. Make sure you, if you are cycling, I see so many people in Lincoln. I mean, Eva will attest to this.
Yes.
Where they actually, you just think they've got themselves a death wish. Clearly, you know.
I see people driving along, cycling along with earphones, with earphones in, no helmet.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah, it's pointless. Kind of you're cutting off all sorts of things there. Anyway, next question.
And will we be hearing again from you soon?
Well, I think next Thursday, isn't it, Alex?
I think that's probably going to be the case. We'll squeeze in that with four folk from Newcastle and Professor Scott Davidson, Deputy Vice-Chancellor of the University of Lincoln. Outrageous!
I'd just like to say one more thing, actually. You know there's an Australian chap you had last week?
Yes.
Yeah, when he was doing the Peter Mars interview, which I thought was very funny, actually. Very good indeed. He said at one point, it was sort of like, a sandpit, and then it went to a sandpit again.
Yes.
Well, they did, but his sandpit was in Spain.
Exactly.
So it just shows you can travel all across the world, and it still looks like a bloody sandpit.
He was an Australian. It was his first show. I wanted to ease back. He'd probably come back with us, etc. I thought, in the light of the Rugby World Cup, best not to actually sort of push it too far. Yeah. Alan Stevens will return.
Bye-bye.